Welcome to another Player 2 review discussion. My name is Stephen Del Prado, and I'm here this evening with Jason Hawkins to talk about his review of Rise of the Ronin. Jason, how are you?
I am doing well. How about yourself?
I'm quite good. Now, earlier you mentioned that you've got a considerable amount of playtime in Rise of the Ronin. Exactly how many hours have you put into the game?
So I am now up to 128 hours. I imagine that if in a beautiful world where I had a lot more time, I would probably put another like 40, 50 hours into the game.
Good Lord. Now, I'm only about 10 hours in, so clearly I'm very much the amateur to your grandmaster. My initial impressions so far have been mixed. It's in some ways what I expected it to be, and in other ways it's very, very different than what I was initially expecting, given the premise and given the pedigree of the developer. Did you want to speak to some of the titles that you would maybe compare it favorably against and that you think it might falter in comparison to?
Sure. So the ones that come to mind most of all are obviously going to be other Team Ninja titles. It reminds me a lot of Stranger of Paradise, partially in the way that it has three-player co-op for missions, partially in the way that once the game is finished for the first time, a new difficulty is unlocked, a new loot pool is unlocked, and everything gets a whole lot harder. So it's kind of, you know, the whole game's not new game plus starts over, but like gets a whole new layer once you've finished. Very much like Neo in the way that the combat works, or even like Souls-like. I wouldn't say it's Soulsian in the same way, but that does feel similar. And the open world feels a lot more like the newer Assassin's Creed games, for better and worse.
Yeah, I guess that's one of my main bugbears so far, even only 10 hours in, is that the open world very much gives me L.A. Noire vibes, or some of those other games where there's just sort of large swathes of things with not really much to do. And it's something that I think we haven't seen in a few generations in terms of that sort of open world design.
Yeah, it's I saw an article with the headline of Rise of Ronin's open world would have been the best game of 2013. And I'm like, that's pretty accurate.
Yeah, again, it really is. It's like, you know, you're sort of cruising around and there's stuff there, but none of it is interesting outside of maybe the architecture and just the general, if you're a fan of that sort of period, you know, the gunboat diplomacy that Japan was facing at that point, then that's like about it. Obviously, like unlocking the glider and I'm sort of gliding around and I'm like, what is the point of this? There's nothing even exciting to do with this aspect of the game.
I 100% agree with you. The open world part of this, like Team Ninja hasn't done, I can't think of any open world stuff they've done before. And I think they're stepping into this. I don't think they've nailed it. I think you're exactly right in the way that it doesn't feel like there's that much to do. Like we're coming off, we're coming into the stage where Dragon's Dogma 2 has come out, and that's a game that is staunchly against fast travel. It has it, but it's fairly against it. And their idea is that if your world is interesting, then you won't need fast travel, or at least you don't need it as much. And the irony here is that Rise of the Ronin is packed full of fast travel because there's nothing going on. Like once you complete an area, you know, there's a couple of things I find interesting in the world. There's like your little tournaments, whether that be fighting in the dojo or doing firearms training or glider training or those sort of things. They're actually pretty fun. But anything other than that is just like going to a point and doing a thing. I also don't mind the like freeing a camp. Those are kind of interesting just because it like leads into the combat. But anything other than that is just like, it's nothing.
Yeah, it's kind of like Kmart Ghost of Tsushima. Like it's not quite there, and the encounters don't feel as exciting. It's very much like that Ubisoft open world kind of rote game design. Maybe even Far Cry-ish a little bit. Like you come to an outpost and you've got to take it down, and maybe there's a few little bonuses for doing it in a particular order, but those don't really feel necessary because it's a Team Ninja game. You're just like wading through rivers of loot to try to
God, there's so much loot.
It really is, and it's that sort of like, ooh, do I want the swords with 72 attack, or do I want the swords with 73 attack, but with a 2% bonus to a thing I don't care about?
Yeah. Later on, that does become much more useful, where you're, like, looking at every piece of gear going, is this going to be better, is this going to be worse? But, like, yeah, at the start, it's so useless. But thankfully, like, it was halfway through the game before I looked through all the menus and found out, oh, there's actually a way to, like, auto-disassemble gear of a certain rarity, or there's a way to, like, automatically pick up things that I don't want to worry about, or, like, auto-crouch when I'm doing certain things. None of that is, like, up front. And so I spent so much time, like, getting rid of inventory that I just did not want and was fairly useless, like, up until halfway through the game. It was awful. It was truly awful.
Yeah, it's not very well tutorialized. I even found that in between just my first and second session, like, I've found the combat to be slightly overwrought and the control scheme to not assist that in any way. Like, a lot of the things you're doing are hold a trigger and then push in a direction to do a specific thing. And if you forget what that is, like, I remember my second or third session, I completely forgot how to switch characters. Yep. And I'm in the middle of this combat encounter and I'm furiously pushing all the triggers to see how I switch to my other character, because the character I was playing as, their weapons weren't as effective as the other characters, so I needed to swap to them, but I could not remember how to do it.
Yep. It is awful. Like, the combat is really good. It's really advanced, but the controls are so rough. Because I'm playing on the hardest difficulty now, trying to do all of that stuff, like, on the fly, in the middle of combos, like, switching up between weapons or switching between combat styles. Oh, God, it's so hard to keep track of. And then keeping track of your items as well, which you're needing to, like, you know, scroll through. I read in my review that you kind of need to be a cephalopod to make it work, and I stand by that. It's challenging in a way that is not necessarily fun. Just to fight against the controls. Thankfully, the camera's pretty good, though. So.
Yeah, no, I never had an issue with the camera. It does put me in the mind of Neo in terms of, like, it's them trying to build upon that, which had obviously the stance system, so you're having to switch through your different stances and things like that. And then, you know, you've got, like, your active reload you can do to get some of your stamina back and things like that.
Yeah.
But it layers on that so densely, so quickly that it can... I can foresee a lot of people becoming overwhelmed very early on in the game, because it's not very well signposted either. No. Like, I spent the first few hours wondering, am I doing the right thing, or like, should I be doing something else? It feels like it's progressing weirdly fast in some aspects.
Yeah. It doesn't drip feed content at all. It just, like, here's everything you need to do in combat, work it out. And the difficulty is such that I didn't necessarily feel the need to do some of that, but then I got into the hardest difficulty and suddenly it's like, hey, all those things that you haven't been doing for the last 80 hours, you need to do those all now. Because, like, I was never blocking. I was always trying to do the counter sparks. But when you get to the hard mode, you got to start blocking, because if you're not, you're going to die. And the same with the key flash. So every time you finish a combo, you can do your little spark and get a bunch of key back. I never had to do that because I just wasn't running out of key. And then suddenly I need to do that. And it's horrendous.
One of the things I found with that system, interestingly enough, and maybe it's just me, is that I don't find the game visually signposts when to counter spark or when to block well. You have to pay attention to the audio.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. So I kind of started treating it almost like a rhythm game, where I can I can pay a little bit of attention. You don't have a lot of time. It is pretty tight on those attacks, but, like, once a combo starts to spool up, you can kind of get into the rhythm of, like, block, 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 and then block again, and then you get used to that. But if I had audio off, I couldn't do it at all.
No, and I guess that's something that, you know, these days isn't necessarily very good for certain players, like, to have that reliance on sound, because I just found that the animations are such that, and they've got some of those, like, faint attacks and things like that really have the variable speed, so it's like a wind up and you're not quite sure, so you can't necessarily read the visuals, but the sound effect is when and that sort of aligns with a lot of my experience with Sekiro. It was very much rhythmic combat in terms of your parrying and your blocking.
I think that's what they were going for here. I like I said, I really love the combat in it, but man, it is a lot. If you don't have the background of a lot of Souls games, I can imagine this being incredibly difficult. I was reading up post review on people that are not used to Souls game, and they had it on the easier difficulties. They were having trouble, but they were making it through. So that's kind of nice in the way they can sort of drip feed in that way, but it's so much front loaded, it's rough.
Yeah, and obviously the difficulty is I guess one of the biggest features here. We know that most Soulsborne games don't give you a difficulty option, and this is pretty upfront, although it is doing the nice, dawn, dusk, twilight sort of. They're not really saying they're not easy, normal, hard, insane. It's, they're trying to, and it doesn't seem like anything is tied to trophies either in terms of the difficulty.
There is one where you have to complete a mission on midnight difficulty, which is the post-game difficulty, but there are missions, a lot of them will be fairly simple. It's not too bad.
So do you think that that is going to help open the door up to some of those, obviously our illustrious editor Matthew Hewson is famed for his disdain of most Soulsborne titles and, would happily play around with those systems and in those worlds, but, the demands of the combat and the way it gatekeeps content generally keeps him, and I know a lot of other people, away from them. Do you think that lower difficulty will cater to them?
I don't think that. I think that there's such a reputation of these games that it's going to keep people out regardless, and because of the way the combat gives you so much straight up, there is some assistances that you can put in. I saw in the options that there's an ability to if you hit a button, it'll just do a combo. Not a crazy combo, but it is you can just hammer on a button to do, a decent combo. So, there is that little bit of accessibility in there. I think if the open world was more exciting, it would entice a lot more players in. But because it's not, and the combat is the only other part of it, I think it'll probably still keep them out. Which is a shame.
In terms of, obviously, I'm much farther than, behind than you are in the game. In terms of mission design, does that hold up?
Yeah. I the missions are the most exciting bit for me. I very much dislike that the co-op is only for the missions, because there's really difficult stuff to do in the world that would have been fun with players, like those really hard bounties, etc. Would be fun to do with players, but I think the missions are kind of exciting. I'm a massive history buff. Especially when it comes to the Bakumatsu period, which is what this is set in. It's such a tumultuous time for early Japan. And this entire period is setting up for Japan's part in World War II. That's how important what is currently happening there is. So getting to play around with that was super duper exciting for me. And seeing the key points be told in that narrative was very exciting. I think that the missions are, I think they hold up very well, because they I think that there's some really good narrative points that gets hit in them. And I think that in those late missions, there's a lot happening all at once, which is very exciting. Honestly, the missions are by far the best part of this game.
Do you think that then the open world detracts from that? If it had have been more like Neo and some of Team Ninja's previous work, where it's, some of those co-op compatible missions, where it almost feels instanced rather than, it feels like its own distinct part of or a slice of the game. Do you think that maybe having foregone that open world would have improved the pacing somewhat of the game?
I think it would have. There would have to be a lot of changes made to the game to make it not have that open world. Because a lot of the time you're running around and learning your combat styles and things from that, and, you know, speaking to people and building up your bonds with them, as much as I hate that system. it's a lot. I think that the open world does detract from it. It also, like, as I said, because the open world doesn't allow co-op, if you are playing with a friend, you go into a mission, then you go and do something, like, you go into the mission, you join up with your friend, you do the mission together, and then you have, like, downtime in between where they just get kicked from the session, and then you have to invite them again when you get to the next mission. I'm like, that sucks. That really sucks.
Do you think that's something they can fix with some patches, though?
I hope so. Like, Elden Ring was the same way, in that players were only allowed in for boss arenas. Admittedly, players created an asynchronous mod for people to be able to play together. I don't know if they'll do it for this. I hope they do. If it's anything like Stranger of Paradise, I think they'll add in some DLC, which will, you know, DLC or patches, you know, paid or not, that will change up some of the content and maybe bring in that co-op element. I hope it does, because that would be really fun for me.
It's interesting some of the Assassin's Creed comparisons you made. Obviously, the setting and the story it's telling and the inclusion of real-world historical figures all align with that sort of design philosophy. Do you also feel that this is an Assassin's Creed 1 situation whereby if it does well enough to get a sequel, they can probably iron out some of these flaws?
I hope so. I had a lot of fun with the game, and I continue to. I think it's just because it's their first time in open world, in the same way that Assassin's Creed 1 was just woeful. Like, they didn't understand it at all, but Assassin's Creed 2, really, really good. So I hope that they continue to play around with this space, because I think they've nailed most of it. I gave my review was quite a bit higher than the norm out there. I think the Metacritic, it's sitting at about 75. I gave it a 9 out of 10. So I had a lot of fun with it, but you know, I have my own biases there of number one, the time period; number two, the developer; and number three, the type of game it is, that are all ticks in my box. But I truly hope that they play around with this a little bit more and bring out something else in this space that, you know, works on that open world a lot better.
Do you think it is maybe suffering from some of those comparisons? Obviously, we've got a lot of games that aren't necessarily in the exact same time period or have, you know, maybe more fantastical elements, but between things like Neo and Ghost of Tsushima and Sekiro and lots of other titles that are playing in that space, do you think that Rise of the Ronin inevitably is struggling to live up to some of the expectations other reviewers might have had based on those titles?
It's possible. I definitely see, like, the complaints that we've said are definitely common ones across other reviews. I try not to read too many other reviews, but they were definitely some points that came up. I think that the comparisons to Ghost of Tsushima are pretty apt, but I think whenever you go into a game, and I mean this for any game, it's so important to be able to try and leave those biases at the door. Because just because a game is different to another one you've played doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad. It's just that it's different. And, like, when you think, oh, this should be more like Ghost of Tsushima, or this should be more like Sekiro, you're going to get into, like, a world of hurt, because games are designed differently. Yeah, which makes it very difficult. It's actually, I have a very staunch opinion on, like, the way I look at games, and I almost never look at any pre-release content. I never look at any previews or anything like that. I just go into it, and whatever I play, I play. And that's, I always go in with a relatively clean slate. That's what I did here. I knew that this was a Team Ninja game. I knew that I liked some of their other stuff, so I'm like, okay, I'm on board. I know I like their style of combat, and then I just went in and I went, okay, this is what it's like. I kind of get what they're doing here.
I think I sort of went in the same way. I didn't even realize it was something that was coming out until like maybe 2 months ago, because I don't really keep my finger on the pulse of a lot of, you know, AAA stuff that's coming out anyway.
It's a good way to be.
And like obviously the pedigree was exciting. I did enjoy my time with Neo, and I have enjoyed a number of other Team Ninja titles. The Stranger of Paradise comparison is interesting because I think I played the demo of that, and I never got around to playing the full game.
It's so good. It got the short end of the stick because it had all those memes before it came out about, oh, I'm going to kill Chaos. And that's what very much put it in the limelight. And people were thinking, oh, this is a bit silly. But I played it, and it's great. I think I've put probably about 250 hours into Stranger of Paradise now. Like, the things they did to that game post-launch were absolutely phenomenal. Like, amping up the difficulty, releasing new difficulties, changing the loot pool, making you want to play more, but also making it more difficult at the same time. Really, really cool way to do it. Yeah, so I'm hoping to see more of that from this.
How viable an approach do you think that would be for Rise of the Ronin to have that sort of post-launch support?
I think this is a tough one. I think it depends a lot on the developer, and I think it depends on a lot of the sales of the game. This one is going to be interesting because it's a PlayStation exclusive for now. Who knows if there's going to be a PC version in the future. There probably will be, knowing the way that Sony is going at the moment. Sony have been pretty good about the way that they have done their post-launch for their first-party titles, so I'm hoping that extends to third-party as well. I think if they do that, if the game sells well, it's reviewed decently well. I haven't seen any sales numbers for it. Normally people keep that pretty close to their chest. But I think if it sells well, there'll be a reason for them to give post-launch support for it. Otherwise, it'll just be patches, which would be a shame.
It put me in the mind of Days Gone in terms of, obviously, it was not in such a rough state during its review period, so it didn't get hit with those technical complaints. But it really seems to me like the sort of game that's really going to hit for some people, and a lot of other people are going to ignore it, or they're going to hear, oh, 7 out of 10, I won't bother.
Yeah. I think that's such a wild thing in the games industry at the moment of like this. Well, I say at the moment, it's been this way for as long as I've been in games, which is, what, 21 years I've been writing now. Where people see a 7 out of 10, they're like, oh, this is not worth my time. Some of my favorite games are 6s and 7s out of 10. Like, I love Harvest Moon. I don't think I've seen almost any of those review above a 7. Yeah, I love those types of games. But people see a 7 and they're just like, it's not worth it. Like, 7's and good. I'd love 7s.
I think if you really got down to brass tacks, a lot of people would probably find that they actually agree with that statement. Everyone can say they enjoy the 8s and the 9s and the 9.5s and the 10s out of 10s, but I think when you really pressure people, very few of them will say, oh, that's my absolute favorite game.
Yeah.
It's a game you enjoy, but I don't think it's necessarily one that would be your favorite. I think there has to be those weird, interesting hooks or spikes or some weirdness that makes other people cringe that is just absolutely right up your alley, and that's what really hooks you into a game.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, to only look at games that are absolutely peak of their genre, you're going to be spoiled for literally everything else because you're going to be expecting those massive, massive highs. Most games don't have that. They just don't have that at all. But if you look at some of those weirder stuff or the stuff that doesn't get as much coverage or anything like that, I think you'll be honestly really in for some great gems.
What are your favorite weird hooks in Rise of the Ronin?
So I thought the glider was absolutely bananas. Such a weird thing to have. It's such a, like, I remember back that there was a meme about, I don't know, 10 years ago about the Year of Luigi. And ever since then, I've kind of put in the back of my mind, every year has like a thing that is associated with it. I swear to God, like, half the games I've played already this year have gliders. So I'm dubbing this one the Year of the Glider. It is a very weird thing to have. I get why it's there. But it's very strange. Like, cause you're going through like, your sword play, your weapon play, is all pretty realistic, pretty good. And you just like jump off a cliff and suddenly this glider sprouts out of your back. Baffling. But you know what? It's there and it's fun. in the same way, the grappling hook was very strange. As you level it up, you can, like, when you stagger enemies, you can pick them up and throw them, or if someone throws something at you, you can grab it and throw it back, or you can grab stuff out of their hands and take it, and it's weird, but it's awesome. It's so much fun.
Yeah, it's, I mean, with the glider, it's almost like you can't have an open world game without some sort of, like, since Breath of the Wild, yep, it's like an unwritten rule. You can't, because instantly everyone's going to be like, well, where's my glider?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Absolutely. I have to, like, just try to find my way down off this cliff without just falling to my death and hitting a reload screen.
Back in my day, we suffered with just a horse, but no, not anymore.
And, yeah, the grappling hook is really interesting. Obviously, I guess that's one of the things is that there are some traversal options in this, and you can combine that with the glider, but it really never feels like it's in service of anything greater. It's like a cool thing you can do, and absolutely, I found some hidden chests up on tall buildings and things like that, but outside of that, it's like you can do this thing, but at a certain point, you're going to wonder why.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, it is, like, sometimes you just get to the top of a tower and you're like, there's nothing up here. Why did I climb this? Like, oh, well, it's fun. And then you just glide off and you're like, okay, I kind of get it. Very weird.
This may be into spoiler territory. I'm not really far enough to know, but does it get weird and mystical? Is there any of that sort of stuff in there?
No. Because it's based on a historic period. Like, there's some stuff that's, like, folklore-ish? A little strange. Yeah, a little folklore-ish. Not too much, but like a tiny bit. But no, they play it pretty close to the chest.
Because I was wondering, I'm like, I wonder if that's their angle for any sort of DLC. If they do that, it's like, that's where they go.
They could go the Undead Nightmare route. Like maybe Japan just... Maybe the cholera makes everyone turn into zombies or something. Who knows?
Yeah, it's suddenly like Forbidden Siren or something like that. It just,
God, I wish. We've got the camera.
Yeah, I could do it.
Yeah.
So in terms of the difficulty levels, I found the regular difficulty pretty in line with most Souls experiences. And obviously, like you can one-shot a lot of the bosses if you have experience with the previous Souls games. I did drop it down to play around with that, and it felt very much like, as you intimated, you can ignore a lot of the combat mechanics at that lower difficulty level. They don't really matter as much.
Mm.
And you're at the post-game difficulty level now. Yep. How would you characterize that? What to give people something to compare it against?
Insanely hard. It's insanely hard. So you know how when you take on a area, it's got like the stronger enemies. On the midnight difficulty, those stronger enemies will kill you in two hits. And when you do an assassination on them, you will probably take off maybe 15% of their HP. So you can't cheese them at all. You need to get into combat and you need to be goddamn good at it. Like, the aim of it is kind of make sure you're counter-sparking everything. Otherwise, you're going to die. It's tough. It is really tough.
And do you think that's manageable? Are the enemy types like sort of from a template so that once you know how to approach that particular enemy type, you can just do it consistently? Or is there that much variety that's kind of hard to do?
I thought this was actually one of the super duper interesting parts of the game is that, like, even the similar enemy types, if they've got a different weapon, they've got a whole different set of combos. So it retains that. You very much have to learn, okay, this is what that enemy is. This is what type of combos they're going to be using based on that. Sometimes, also, just to make life a little bit fun, some enemies switch up their weapons in the same way that you do, which now means that you have to do something similar, either change your combat style or change your weapon around. It's very much a thing of, like, you're never going to 100% learn every single enemy, but if you go up against something enough, like, I have died to one of the enemies in one area, like, maybe 50 times. So I'm pretty good at its combos now. But when I face another type of enemy, it might be using something completely different, and all that knowledge will be useless.
That sounds like a really interesting way to approach sort of the thing that I have taken the biggest umbrage with in the development of FromSoft games is the multi-phase boss fight or the multi-phase enemy fight. And it sounds like having them switch weapons is kind of an interesting way to approach that.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't happen too often, thankfully. So you do get kind of used to enemies just having one style, and they don't switch it up. Well, actually, I haven't seen them switch it up based on the weapon I'm using, but maybe I'm using the same type of weapon so they can, you know, keep that rock, paper, scissors against me. I think that it's very interesting in the way they've done it. And because there's not too many enemies that switch up their weapons, you can kind of keep that rhythm going.
So that's post game. Is there new game plus, or is it that you're just going around doing some other missions and things like that?
So once you've done with the game, you've got let me back that up a bit. Once you get to chapter 2 for the first time, you get the like book, which I can't remember the name of off the top of my head, but that allows you to replay missions. Once you get to the end of the game, you can. It doesn't give you a new game plus, but it very much is, hey, you can still use that book. You can go back to the world as it was in certain chapters. You can redo specific missions. And in the if you switch to that hardest difficulty, the world, some of the things in the world are repopulated. So like the dojo now has the same enemies, but they're all at the hardest difficulty and they've now got new rewards. All of the areas that you have cleansed before, the outposts are now full, but they've got more difficult enemies. All of the bounties now are there again, but they're now much, much harder. And you can also go back, even if you didn't want to do that, didn't want to step into the hardest difficulty, you can go back and replay those other missions, or just go back to a previous chapter and like, you know, level up your bonds with people, or alternatively make different choices. If you made specific choices throughout the game that you want to undo, you can go back and just change those choices up to like give yourself a little bit of a different experience.
It sounds pretty interesting. And again, like, yeah, fairly like fluid in terms of how it lets the player engage with it, which I think is quite cool. Do you foresee them doing a new game plus? Do you think the game would work with that approach?
If it's anything like Stranger of Paradise, they won't give a new game plus. It's very much just a, hey, here are the missions, here's the difficulty you can play it on, or you can up it if you want to. And if you do that, you got more rewards. So it doesn't really need that new game plus in the same way.
Now, 130 hours is pretty intimidating. What do you think the average playthrough time would be for, you know, someone who's not as enamored of what Rise of the Ronin is doing as yourself?
So I think if you were just mainlining it, I say when I finished it at 81 hours, but I did literally everything because I am an absolute psychopath when it comes to games. I think if you're mainlining it, you'll probably get through it in like 40, 50 hours, which is not too bad. Honestly, that's about how much you'd want it to be.
And yeah, like that's still considerable in, you know, a world where a lot of AAA games sort of run out of steam around the 25 hour mark. Getting 40 to 50, that's edging into JRPG territory, really.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, maybe my period of time is skewed, my perception of time rather is skewed, because most of the games I play are anywhere between 50 and 500 hours. Like, I'm an absolute sucker for JRPGs, and you know, I play a lot of like factory management games like Factorio and Satisfactory, where you play like hundreds of hours. So yeah, maybe my time is skewed, but I think that you could probably even get that down a little further if you were absolutely just sticking to the main path.
Yeah, drop it to the lowest difficulty, fast travel everywhere, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I think that's totally fine. Like, it's good that developers are giving those options for, you know, people to experience games how they want to. Like, there's long been that argument about, like, should Souls games have a difficulty setting? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Like, Some people want to play a Souls game, but they don't want to, like, absolutely get the heck beaten out of them. And to have those options is really nice. Like, that's by, like, not having the difficulty settings, you're gatekeeping people because you're like, you need to play at this level or you cannot get through.
Yeah, it's...
And this just gives people the option.
It's gatekeeping. That's what it really is. Yeah. I have argued for a while now that I think games alongside difficulty settings should have, how long do you want this to take?
Oh, yeah.
Like, give me a little option at the front. Like, do you want this to be 20 hours, 30 hours, 40 hours? Yeah. Like, there are a lot of things they can adjust in those games. Like, I wouldn't care if it's just like, okay. And for someone like yourself, I think you'd probably appreciate this. What if when I hit, I want it to be done in 30 hours, they just don't show me half the icons on the map? They just don't exist for me. It doesn't. Yeah. It's not a thing I even have to worry about.
Or, like, even in this game, like, if it just goes, like, just straight mission to mission, awesome. And it just unlocks stuff for you, like, in the background. Like, it doesn't have to be everything, obviously. Like, they'll give you a little smorgasbord, like, some options, and always needed in games.
Yeah, it starts you with a loadout, and, you know, I've got a slightly better loadout. And I think that is where I would like to see some of these games progress to. And I think it could honestly lead to not just more people engaging with them, but more people actually finishing them, because the stats on people finishing games are abysmal.
Yeah. It's awful. It is truly awful. Yeah, I think that's a great idea, honestly. I think kick that up the chain, and hopefully we'll start to see that. It'd be nice. It would be nice. Well,
I think the company that I would love to see do it the most to sort of start the whole trend would be Ubisoft, to just boot up an Assassin's Creed, and they say, how much time you got? 20 hours? We can get this done in 20 hours. Let's go.
God, if I could have had 40 hours cut of my Skull and Bones review, I would have been so happy.
But wouldn't it be interesting to see what that would do to people's perception of games then? Because I think one of the things that I find so difficult, and that's why I get scared off when I hear, 100 plus hours, is pacing. So many games are so bad at pacing.
Oh, yeah. Looking at you, JRPGs.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, having just finished up Rebirth myself for that review, and it's easily a 100-hour game if you want to do everything, let alone if you really want to get into the nitty-gritty of what is doing everything in the context of the Golden Saucer, what is doing everything in the context of materia breeding, all of those sorts of things. And I think that would be, very interesting to have that as, a preface to a review. The reviewer chose to play within the 30-hour completion window.
Yeah, I honestly think, like, because of the difficulty settings in this game, I think that you could probably just go mission to mission without touching much of that open world stuff, and you'd be okay. Like, it does give optional missions in the way of, like, once you level up your bonds with a specific person, sometimes they'll have a side mission you can do that is useful or will unlock new things or whatever. But, like, I think if you just wanted the story, and you could probably mainline this and not have to worry about all that side stuff. Like, because the game's pretty generous with its, well, actually very generous with its loot, and you could probably just take a new weapon every time you see one, and you'd be okay. So it doesn't have it in the same way, but, like, because of the way the game is built, you could probably just mainline those missions.
Do you think that its release so close to Dragon's Dogma 2 and so soon after Final Fantasy VII Rebirth was a misstep?
Yes, I absolutely do. Everyone I know did not know that Rise of Ronin was coming out. They were either 100% focused on still Helldivers or Final Fantasy VII or Dragon's Dogma. Yeah, you're always going to have those issues with games. Sometimes I remember reading recently about a dev that had worked on a indie game of his for like 10 years, put it out on Steam, it was on new and trending, and then EA dropped all of the Command & Conquer games and just like pushed it right out. Timing's always going to be a huge thing for games. This one, if this released in a month where people don't have that much to play, that would have been really smart, but there must be some reason, whether it be fiscal year or whatever, that they need to get it out by the end of March.
That, and as well as obviously, like, we know Final Fantasy VII is a huge title for Sony, and we know that Dragon's Dogma, just by virtue of being made by Capcom, generally has very strong ties to PlayStation being a Japanese, piece of hardware in and of itself.
Yeah, it's a wild ride. Like, I think that ironically, the most important thing I think is this was to come out on PC in like a year, I think it'd do really, really well. In the same way that Forbidden West has done really, really well on PC, and that's only just come out in like the last couple of weeks, even though all those other games have come out. Forbidden West is still at the top. So I think if this gets a re-release or a Game of the Year edition or something else to put it back into the limelight a little bit later in the year, even if that was to be a big patch, it'll make all the difference. But at the moment, not that many people know about it, which is a shame. I've been espousing it, I've been yelling its name from the rooftops because I think it's super duper cool, but there's so many games. There's so many games.
I think it's one of those ones as well that it might also benefit from a little bit of a price drop. So 2, 3 months, if it gets down to, $60 or something like that, I think that's when a lot of people might scoop it up.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Even if it had a timed demo on, I don't know if it does or not. I never pay attention to demos, but if it had a timed demo on PlayStation Plus, I think that'd be great
It
as well.
did have a demo, I think.
Okay, all
Did it have a demo?
Well, I'm gonna eat my words. How awkward.
I will have to check that because I might be getting confused with something else.
There's so many games.
There are so many games. Did you have any final points that you wanted to sort of make about Rise of the Ronin?
Only that if you are interested in the history of it, in this period, definitely go read. There is plenty of books out there about it, or podcasts, or anything similar. It is a super duper interesting time for Japan, where like their technology gets like phased through multiple, like they get pushed through like 50 to 100 years of technology in like 10 years. And it's absolutely bonkers. So if you are interested in that, if this game wets your whistle at all for that, there's some really, really cool stories that the game doesn't touch on that I would recommend going out to read.
And maybe grab a Like a Dragon Ishin as well, because I think it's
Absolutely.
playing around in a similar time period as well, but obviously a very different game in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us to talk about Rise of the Ronin, Jason. People can obviously find your review on player2.au. Where can people find you on social media?
They can't. I'm not really on social media. I don't know. I keep mostly to myself. You can find me on Twitter, I guess, at Pesmare, PESMARE. It'll probably be up above my head around here somewhere. Yeah, I exist, I promise.
And what are you working on next? What can we look forward to as your next piece?
God, I don't know. I was thinking about doing an opinion piece on Final Fantasy 14. The expansion pack has just been announced for that. I think I'm just getting code through for TerraTech Worlds, which is kind of a, like almost Lego Space Engineers, which I'm very much looking forward to trying. Other than that, I might do an opinion piece on Elden Ring because I'm about to start it after never playing it before, so it'll be an exciting time all around.
Especially in comparison to Rise of the Ronin. So
Yeah.
hopefully people can keep visiting Player 2 and keep an eye out for some more work from you in the future.
Hell yeah.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Jason. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks all.